Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go. Behind the lens and below the line, with the movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, those producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, mixers and designers, those VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. And, of course, you know how much I love to talk, and you know how much I love film. So, I love coming to you every Monday, or almost every Monday, to give you a front row seat to the cinematic sausage making of who, what, where, when, why, and how. Through these interviews and my reviews. Now, I'm very excited. Those of you who have been listening, my regular listeners, new listeners, and I'm very always happy to have new listeners. You know, make sure if you are listening to this, watching it on YouTube, that, you know, subscribe. Like and subscribe on YouTube. If you're listening to this on Podbean, you know, download it, like it. Or, you know, just go to behindthelensonline.net. You can hear it there. Or a myriad of 20 other podcast platforms. So there's plenty of ways to hear Behind the Lens, the BTL radio show every Monday. And, of course, in perpetuity. Because it doesn't disappear. Once it's up, it's up. But as I said, I'm very excited to bring you this week's show and my exclusive conversation with director Ben Gregor, talking about The Magic Faraway Tree, a film like the book on Enid Blyton's book on which it's based. It keeps the child inside of us alive with good storytelling that speaks to family, imagination, adventure, and risk. And it really is a shared language to us all. Now, I don't know how many of the U.S. audiences are familiar with Blyton's book of the same name, The Magic Faraway Tree. It's a smash. It's been a smash in the U.K. If you aren't familiar with the book, make sure you get it. Find it. You know, expose your children to it. Read it to your children and enjoy it for yourself. I promote literacy along with cinema. Now, you all know I've been under embargo on this one until today, so I'm extra happy that I can bring you this fun and interesting interview with Ben. Now, give you a little bit about the film and the story. Adapted from Enid Blyton's beloved classic novel, The Magic Faraway Tree, the film centers on Polly and Tim and their three children, Fran, Beth, and Joe. They're a modern family forced to relocate to the remote and rustic English countryside due to financial difficulties and Dad Tim, who has pie-in-the-sky ideas about the world, about life, and how you get along. As they adapt to their new lives with no electricity and no Wi-Fi, you can imagine the reaction of three children to this, okay? And none of the modern conveniences that they were used to. The children discover a magical tree deep in the forest outside of this barn farm where they are now living. And in that tree are its extraordinary and eccentric residents, including some very beloved literary characters, Moonface, which is one of my favorites, played beautifully by Nonso Anozie, whose work I have loved ever since I first saw him in Happy-Go-Lucky over 20 years ago. Silky, Dame Wash-A-Lot, which is a hoot and a holler. That character is a hoot and a holler. And she does just that. She washes a lot. And it's her little wheel, her washing wheel, that decides what adventure land you get to go visit for the day. There's Saucepan Man, Mr. What's-His-Name, and Oom Boom Boom. At the top of the tree where all of these people live, they are transported to spectacular, fantastical lands, like the land of goodies, the land of birthdays, the land of back to front, the land of know-alls. And it's through the joys and challenges of these adventures that the kids go on, that the family learns to reconnect and value each other for the first time in years. There is no screen time, people, in the Magic Faraway Tree. Now, directed by Ben Greger, written by Simon Farnaby, based on Enid Blyton's beloved novel, The Magic Faraway Tree stars Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy as Tim and Polly. Nonzo Anozie, Nicola Coughlin, Jessica Gunning, Jennifer Saunders, Rebecca Ferguson, Dustin Demery Burns, Oliver Chris, Mark Heap, and more. And hey, screenwriter Simon Farnaby even has a small little role as Farmer Brian. So you want to be on the lookout for him. But the real magic and wonder and fun of the Magic Faraway Tree comes courtesy of the incredible crafts artisans who bring the worlds to life. And that includes, along with their respective teams, cinematographer Zach Nicholson, whose work is to die for. Editor Gary Dolner, who comes out of a strong episodic television background and tackles the editing job here. Production designer Alexandra Walker, award-worthy. Let's just say, award-worthy. Art directors Janet Harwood, Hannah Mosley, and Joe Riddell. Composer Isabella Summers, and costume designer Anne Maskery, whose work here is truly award-worthy. Any Academy members, are you listening? Listen, see this film. Anne's work is stunning, as are all of the crafts, including hair and makeup. I have to say, it was a real joy to speak with Ben about the Magic Faraway Tree. We started off chatting, and I had to excise this from the opening of the interview. He has such a wonderful sense of humor. And because of the fact that this was an audio interview and not on camera, we were joking, and he was saying, yes, you know, he can just relax in the bath and talk about the film, put his dressing gown on. He is so lighthearted. You can hear the whimsy and the childlike wonder as he talks about this film. And I think that's one of the things that you're going to pick up on immediately. But as we start examining the adaptation of such a beloved book that is both freeing and freewheeling. So as a director, you've really got to hone in on your vision. And very important to Ben was steeping the movie world in what he calls Blytopia. Yes, Enid Blyton she's created a world that is very, very specific with rules. And he incorporated rules into this production. And you're going to hear him break down those rules. It's a frothy, light, pure delight with serious crafts. And Ben highlights the film's fanciful and imaginative elements, particularly the importance of staying true to Blyton source material while adding creative touches, as he described the meticulous set design, not the least of which includes, get this people, edible sets, everything organic, as much as humanly possible, and the absence of plastic. There was nothing plastic anywhere in this film or on set. So, and as we keep climbing up our own Magic Faraway Tree discussion, and all of its utterly enchanting, fanciful, and kooky fun, we take a look at the elements of scale, the use and design of practical effects, Zach Nicholson's gorgeous cinematography, and the use of color and contrast, within the faraway world and a differential with the real world. And the transition as you go from the faraway world and you come back down the tree and you go through a forest and get into real life. And then when it comes to Gary Dolner's editing, it is beautiful, seamless on every level. Gary delivers some exquisite montage sequences. One in particular that is slow motion montage. It's very family centric and it's just beautiful. And the work of Zach and Gary just showcases the creativity and magic that comes from Alexander Walker's production design, the art direction teams, and Maskery's costuming, and the fanciful hair and makeup. Now, as Ben explains, which I found very interesting, is that this production required they invent new techniques to achieve Ben's desired result and to keep us in a Blytopian world. Everything had to be found, salvaged, made, or created in-house with a Swiss Family Robinson ingenuity. Real-world machinery, like a big drilling screw, had to echo fantasy inventions. On every level, the fantasy world is mirrored in the real world, underlining the power of inspiration and imagination. Striving for authentic wonder and adventure so that reactions, particularly the kids, would be genuinely gobsmacked, everything was grounded in a world you could touch and taste. They even created their own visual effects company to handle what VFX they did use. But Ben is quick to stress, and does so several times, that this is an independent, handcrafted production that leans into physicality and tactility, rather than relying on digital shortcuts. Now, discussing his key philosophies in making the film, Ben expounds on his thoughts on collaboration, the power of the words, "I don't know," and creating an environment where people's first drafts actually end up in the film. And he has some great thoughts on that last part. I mean, how many of you, if you knew what you were doing, what you were creating, what you were writing, there was no second chance. This had to be the best of the best. I love hearing what he had to say about that. And I think all of you filmmakers will love hearing it. And it really is something that we can all apply to our everyday lives. Now, as we tie in elements of the Magic Faraway Tree with its nods to other fantasy worlds, we talk about Matilda, James and the Giant Peach, Narnia, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, The Hobbit, and Lord of the Rings, you know, where village life naturally tips over into fantasy. But one of the most wonderful homages within the film is to The Wizard of Oz. And there is a key scene that you may find yourself reaching for tissues. I'm telling you now. And all of this talk of fantasy gives rise to some wonderful anecdotes, personal anecdotes from Ben, particularly one involving his own childhood and a neighbor of his named Roald Dahl. So sit back, relax, and take a listen as director Ben Greger talks about the fantastically wonderful and delightful The Magic Faraway Tree. I have to tell you, Ben, I was utterly enchanted watching this movie. I have not read the book. Now I want to read the book. It is just so fanciful. It's kooky. It's fun. You've got some great scale that you're using. I love you have a lot of practical effects that are being done. Your Zach's cinematography is just gorgeous, and the way you use color and you contrast the worlds, as well the fanciful worlds, the faraway worlds, as well as contrasting it from nature and from the real world, and then you put this in the hands of Gary to edit, and it's just beautiful, seamless on every level. Yeah. This is a, it's frothy, light, a pure delight. I love the film, Ben.
Oh, well, so kind of you. Thank you, Debbie. What a nice summation of it.
How do you even start? You get this script from Simon Farnaby. How do you even start plotting this out? Because Enid's book is such, you know, it's so beloved. So when you're adapting something like that, you've got to be really careful. You can either just say, I'm just taking the title. I don't care about what's in the book. Or you're going to stay true to the story and have to make it visually your own. How do you even start with that?
I think you've got to be brave. I think you've got to be brave, but you've got to respect what's brilliant about the source material. Like, Enid Blyton is an amazing writer. She's got a great imagination. It's just incredible. And, you know, you've got to basically come at it as full-hearted and with as much creativity as she has with the writing and make it fearless. And you know, what great thing about Simon's writing is that he doesn't really care how I'm going to make it. Like, it's just my problem. So he will write the hardest things to film in the world, but they're brilliant. And so we kind of had to invent new techniques to do a lot of it. We made our own visual effects company to do what visual effects we needed. But I wanted the kids to always feel that they could be on a practical set and, you know, eat the set in Land of Goodies. The set was edible. I wanted them to, when you see wonder in their eyes, I wanted it to be real. So we made a very crafted tone and feel through everything that we did. I had this phrase, Blytopia, which is kind of like, it's this kind of homely, domestic, you know, kind of, on the one hand, domestic with, like, you know, kind of sandwiches and cake and food and, you know, family chores and family projects, but at the same time, this, like, utopia, you know, bliss of freedom and adventure in all the different contrasting lands that all had to be very different, like you say, and nature really amazing. It's Blytopia. So we had rules like no plastic. There was no plastic in Blytopia. There's not one plastic item in the whole film. You know, we kept just removing it from the sets. Everything was found. We'd make it or we'd create it ourselves, or it was found. You know, if it existed, it was salvaged. You know, we wanted it to be like a sort of Swiss Family Robinson ingenuity of you know, kind of like they do brilliant stuff and they manifest, you know, like the ladder that they go up, you know, it inspires, and the slippery slip, they go up and they come down the slippery slip, which is this kind of amazing tunnel through the middle of the tree. Like when they're making the jars of sauce, it goes down a slippery slip of its own kind of thing, an old screw, kind of big kind of drilling thing. So there's loads of moments when the world, you know, the fantasy world is like mirrored in the real world, so to speak. And you know, that's because the power of inspiration and imagination, I wanted to really manifest that. I wanted to make a big universal film with a lot of heart that makes people cry, but makes them laugh. I wanted to make the kind of movie you watch when you've got flu and you just want, or you're being fired or dumped. You know, this is the movie for you. You know, get under the duvet, or bring a duvet to the theater, of course, you can, which is allowed. You're allowed to bring duvets to the cinema, you know that.
Yes.
It's compulsory in some parts of the United Kingdom. You're not allowed into the cinema without a duvet. That's factual fact. But so I wanted to do that, and, you know, with the team and the cast, we did get to do that. And it's a fully independent film. There's no studio involvement at all. I had two people giving me notes, and they're both very lovely and wonderful. So it was a real old school way of making a film, and I just loved every moment of it.
Well, I have to say, when you mentioned the mirroring, that's one of the things that stood out for me as I was watching the film, is how much the faraway world mirrors the real world. Even down to your characters, you've got Rebecca Ferguson, who does a delicious turn as Dame Snap, but her character and running a school is very much akin to Miss Trunchbull in Matilda.
Of course.
So right away, and that's also very magical and fanciful. So you get that connective umbilical cord of the fun and fancy.
Yes, I mean, Roald Dahl is a touch point in my life. I actually met him. I met Roald Dahl. I was lucky enough. My sister was friends with, she had friends whose families were neighbors. This is when we were really young. And we used to be allowed to go and bang on their door. And sometimes if he felt like it, he would sign books for us or talk to us. But we got to play in the real witch's tree. Like, the witch's tree is a real tree near his the dollhouse in Little Missenden kind of area in Buckinghamshire. And, you know, we would just go and have a picnic in the witch's tree. Or we'd, you know, the Danny Champion of the World caravan, you know, that kind of thing. It was all physically there. So for me, like, I was lucky enough to grow up, you know, kind of in the kind of England, in the kind of United Kingdom that was the birthplace of these mad adventures. And, you know, and things like James and the Giant Peach, Narnia, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, even The Hobbit, right?
Yeah.
And The Lord of the Rings. This is the English countryside. And Lord of the Rings is a lot about the Shire. It's basically much more of those books than you'd realize is just village life. And then suddenly it goes into these magical fantasy things, which is a very natural leap for the traditional English imagination. And I just wanted to, and an amazing American Spielberg artist, you know, like Spielberg, doing, you know, like Hook, you know, J.M. Barry, Scottish writer, you know, it's all just one big, we have so much in common between the UK and America in how we love stories about family and also imagination and risk, that it feels like I really hope audiences find the magic faraway tree in the States. I really hope they think, well, I haven't heard of that, but it looks good, because you don't need to have heard of it. You really don't. You just go and open your minds and hearts and just enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely. And I do have to say, one of your most beautiful homages in here is actually to The Wizard of Oz, when we meet Mr. Boom Boom. And it's just like Dorothy arriving at the Emerald City.
Right.
Trying to get through the gate. Yeah. Right down to the makeup with the mustache, the coloring, just stunning. Stunning.
Amazing. Yeah, Wizard of Oz. The Wizard of Oz is, of course, one of the greatest films of all time. You know, and also The Land of Goodies is a little bit Munchkin-landy, but not too much. I mean,
right.
I think, you know, I also like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. These are just, you know, and The Wizard of Oz is kind of scary too. Like, I remember being quite scared by it. You know, there's that sense of jeopardy, you know, like she will be stuck there. And that's what I wanted to do in the lands. Like, you only have a certain amount of time in the magical lands before they kind of orbit and they'll move off into nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't got down in time, you are not coming back. And you've got to run, and a kind of earthquake happens. And so we wanted to bring all this to life. So we had to shake the set. Everything had to move. We had to do all of this really hard stuff that that we just didn't compromise on. And that's what gives it that sense of kind of like genuine jeopardy, even though it's super crazy and imaginative. And because the kids, things were falling down, and the kids were having to dodge things that were falling down.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it made it so vivid for them. And the kids gave great performances because they're great actors, but also because Andrew and Claire were really present to them. And also we made it so that the sets and the worlds were really tangible to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they just thought it was great.
Well, I got to talk to you about Zach Nicholson and how the two of you developed your visual tonal bandwidth and your visual grammar. Because, as I briefly mentioned, the color contrast, even the tonal contrast, the visual tonal bandwidth for each world is different. And yet everything feels cohesive. And the way your visual grammar speaks to us in terms of camera, framing, blocking. How did the two of you develop your visual grammar?
I mean, Zach works with an amazing operator called Ian McKay, and I would write a shot list every morning, so as I tend to do, like early in the day as I go to the set or at, and I would give it to him and say, here are the shots I want to get today, and he would literally rip up my piece of paper and kind of laugh in my face in a nice, friendly way, because we found it on the day every time. Like, he wanted, they pushed me to be more flowing. They pushed me to, you know, let the camera move the whole time and just be cinematic. And, you know, it was just, it's the first time I really understood what an operator did. Like, I kind of thought operators were just when the DOP was lazy and didn't want to operate himself. So this was a real journey for me in going, oh my gosh, Ian and Zach are just creating this amazing look and feel. Like, for me, the most powerful words as a director are, I don't know. And that's something I'm proud to say a lot. And because the more you say that, the more people come in with ideas. And yes, you need to guide everything. But the idea that you are all-encompassing, you know, a vision, like a cohesive auteur who knows exactly what they want at any one point, that works for some people. I know it does, but it doesn't work for me. Like, I like to make it much more about collaborative and much more people chipping in. And Zach and Ian really made the look of that film. And we had great design from a very good designer, Alex Walker, really good VFX, working closely with Alex. So that was all made to feel like one homemade family from, you know, the idea of Blightopia. So Zach made it very flowing. We had some really great lenses. Ultimately, Zach is just a super nice guy. So we had, it was just a very gentle and relaxed performance. And I think atmosphere on set. So, you know, if you know, DOP and the director, they're sort of mummy and daddy on a set. And if mummy and daddy aren't getting on, like, it's an unhappy place. But he and I, he's just so, so mellow and so great. He lets me be myself. I just let him do what he wanted, really. That's why they just did what they wanted. And that's why it looks so good. But, I think as a director, letting go and saying, I don't know, and what do you want, is really liberating thing to do. Yeah.
No, but the entire visual design is utterly fantastic. And, of course, Alex's production design and your art directors do an amazing job. Good. Of course, you know.
I wanted to create an atmosphere where people's first draft would actually be make it into the film. So, because I think there's a culture of adjusting everything, and it's like over-noting edits, over-noting stuff that are going onto the floor, over-noting actors, and tweaking performances too much. I think I like a first draft. I like a first take. I like a first pass. And, you know, if people think that first draft thing, it could just be what happens, then they work extra hard at it and they make it as crazy as they can. And then when you say, like, it's great, let's just make it, let's do that, and they're just going, they expect you to want to change it for 3 weeks, and you're just like, that's great, next, let's go, put it, build it, build it bigger. And they're just like, oh my gosh. And so it had this sort of crazy unhinged feel about it. So it meant that now when you're watching it, it's got this cohesive craziness about it, because people's first draft is what you're looking at, and that, I'm very proud of that.
And of course, that all of that falls also right into Anne Maskery's bailiwick with the costumes, which are, oh my God, award-worthy turn here by Anne.
I hope so. I think, you know, Anne is just amazing. And again, she would just say, Wasn't's name's costume was completely different until about the day before the shoot. She goes, oh, I've redone Wasn's name's costume because I was bored. And she totally made him into, but she'd had this brilliant thing. So his costume, he's this man, he's kind of got kind of dementia, really. He can't remember his own name. But she made him this kind of, you know, Saruman the Great type kind of wizard costume that just sort of implied that he once was a really powerful wizard with loads of knowledge. And it was so sad. It made it so poignant to dress him in this powerful wizard way when he is just, it's like a sad guy who can't remember his name. And it just, and you know, she's brilliant. She used great materials. A lot of it was naturally printed. Using Silky, Nicola Coughlin's, her costume was printed using actual leaves. Moonface's costume, you know, kind of has like half of it's light and half of it's dark. It has actual real phases of the moon in it. And she was really in touch with nature. She's and it's earthy what she does. And it was all made from scratch. The costume making workshop was the most peaceful place to be in. It's where I used to hide. There's just loads of really lovely people just sewing and doing really insane things.
Aww.
Making boots out of, and I just loved it in there. I used to sit in a little corner like a kind of dog, like a little kind of, like a little basket in the corner of their room. I just loved it in there. I'd happily go there right now.
And now, how challenging, you're working with Gary Dolner doing your editing. You have some beautiful montages in here, including an exquisite family-oriented, climactic, slow-motion montage that just steals your heart. So how challenging was the editing process on this one as we're going from the different worlds and we're doing the transitions beautifully? It was always going through the woods when we go from fantasy into reality and reality into fantasy, which is a beautiful way to transition. But how challenging was this edit for you and Gary?
Well, Neil Street, you know, the production companies, Pippa Harris, Nicholas Brown, Sam Mendes, you know, they are very, very crafty. You know, they like the craft based, right? They're not crafty. They loved the craft of filmmaking and of directing and of creating. And they gave us such a generously huge amount of time to edit. We had time. Aww. And they very much didn't do that many notes. They just noted what they wanted us to look at, but we didn't even have to do them if we didn't want to. They were just so old school and generous in giving us space. Sam Mendes came and edited with us for a little bit, you know, and just hung out. And Gary and I just had the space to take risks and, you know, do stuff and work and work and work. And we brought it down and down faster and faster and faster, you know, because you don't want family films to be too long. But then we just lifted bits of plot out and then let it breathe again. We went back and watched our first ever assembly, which was 3.5 hours long. And then we found loads of bits that weren't essential, but were really lovely and gave amazing texture. And we made the movie so efficient at this point that we could just put some of those back in. So Gary and I were given such an amazing, you know, amount of time and space and trust by the brilliant producers that's why it's a good edit. It's because the producers gave us room. You know, we had no studio notes. We had no. We just worked to. Really, Pippa and Nick and Danny, and they were just so kind to us and let us make mistakes and go down blind alleys and just trusted what we were doing. So that's why the edit feels like it does, is that the producers were so brilliantly trusting.
One quick question before I let you go, Ben. I'm curious, this is such an undertaking. You know, this is not an easy film to make when you have fanciful worlds and reality with the constraints you gave yourself. What did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker that you can take forward into your next films?
I think I just feel like just so lucky. I don't know if I learned anything. All I did, I think I unlearned stuff. I think I just learned that the more you trust people, the more you make a brilliant team around you and just say, what do you want to do? And you know, let them go crazy. That how amazing that is. How amazing the creativity of people in the film industry is, breathtaking. And people at the very top of their game, who we were lucky enough to work with here, who've worked on some just incredible stuff, you know, from Anne Mastry doing Star Wars to... Everybody's done amazing things, and when you let them wind them up and let them go, you get beauty and genius, heart, and the actors. So let people do what they want, as much as you can, and then just watch the magic happen. So I've learned, I think, that I don't know anything, and that is the most liberating and zen place to be.
Well, you definitely learned how to. Much as Timothy and Polly did, they learned how to keep the child within them alive, and so did you in making this movie.
And so you've spoken so kindly about it. Thank you so much, Debbie. I hope that audiences in the States, you know, they come to the same conclusion as you have done about it.
They're fools if they don't. They're fools if they don't, Ben. Oh, Ben, this has been so lovely. I hope we get to chat again in the future.
Me too. Thank you for your amazing thoughts about the film. You're so kind.
Thank you, Ben. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Ben Greger talking about The Magic Faraway Tree, which you can see in U.S. theaters this Friday, August 21st. Don't forget to check out BehindTheLensOnline.net for more movie reviews and interviews. And make sure to join me next week for more insight behind the lens of more new films. Although I'm not yet sure who you'll hear from and what film we'll be discussing. I've got quite a few on interviews this week. A lot of new films that are popping up. We're getting ready for TIFF, Toronto International Film Festival. I'm getting emails on that already, films that that people want covered. So we'll see what's happening. Plus, I'm putting it on your radar now. I can't say much because it's under embargo. Any Chad Powers fans out there? If you aren't already a fan of Chad Powers or you haven't seen it, get thee to Disney Plus and Hulu. Glenn Powell amazes. The series is so much fun. Season 2 premieres on September 2nd or 3rd. I have now binged the 6 episodes of Season 2. I'm ready for Season 3. So mark that on your calendars. That'll be a great binge watch Labor Day weekend. Or as we approach Labor Day weekend at the true end of the summer. And, you know, NFL football starts. And Chad Powers is about, you know, takes place in a football setting. So it works. They put thought into when they were releasing this second season. Tied in with football. And there's a film out there right now that I'm afraid it's going to fly under the radar of most people. It's called The Brink of War. And it is a piece of history that I really hope many of you will go see. It focuses in on the one weekend, the 30 hours that Ronald Reagan met with Mikhail Gorbachev in Reykjavik, Iceland, in a quote-unquote haunted house away from everybody and everything, as they tried to put an end to nuclear armament. It's really interesting. Jared Harris is amazing as Gorbachev. Jeff Daniels plays Reagan. For any of you that have seen Dennis Quaid's portrayal of Reagan in the film Reagan, you're going to have a hard time with Jeff Daniels really embracing and embodying who Reagan is. Although he does have some cadence, he's got Reagan's cadence, he has some mannerisms, but it's a really interesting film from a historical aspect, and it has some beautiful cinematography, some very thoughtful editing and cinematography that is very metaphoric and really speaks to the tensions of the world at the time. And while that, and it's no secret that while that meeting did not result in disarmament, it set the stage for agreements that would then come to fruition in 1987, a year later in 1987 and thereafter. Also, be on the lookout for The Wait with Russell Crowe and Ethan Hawke. That's coming up. The Gentleman Thief is out now. It's on demand. It's on digital. John Travolta. It's okay. If you just want to kick back at home and just pop something on and watch it, it's enjoyable enough. Of course, the big movie doesn't come out this week. Comes out on the 28th. You've all been waiting for it. You've been waiting for it since Ketchup Entertainment saved it from extinction last year. Coyote versus Acme. I am in love with this film. It is almost flawless. It is fantastic. Every Looney Tunes character you can think of pops up in this. This is, I think, the finest blend of live action and animation I have ever seen. So get your tickets now for Coyote versus Acme for August 28th. So I'll remind you again next week next Monday about Coyote versus Acme. But, folks, you will not be disappointed. So, that's enough of my yakking today. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ben Greger. Make sure, go to the theater and see The Magic Faraway Tree this Friday, the 21st. And until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.